Thank you, Patty. Thank you very much, Patty. I appreciate it. Thank you all for coming out here tonight. How many folks were here when I spoke here a couple of years ago? Yeah? Great. That's not too many. Thank you very much for coming out tonight. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to share with you some of my favorite feuds that gives you a sense of the variety of feuds are in the book. So think of it like, we're very big on food at Chronicle. So think of it as sort of like an appetizer course of some delicious little finger feuds. And we're going to work our way up to the main course, which is a delicious dispute. And it has become my favorite feud, one of my favorite stories, actually, that I've stumbled upon in Chronicle. And I think I can guarantee it will be the most fascinating feud that you've never heard of. So one thing that I discovered very early on in researching feuds for the book is that people are fascinated by feuds. They're fascinated by them. It's a little bit like rubbernecking on the highway. You know, it's like you can't quite not find out more about a really, really intense, vicious feud. But there's one exception to that fascination, unless it's yours. People are not as fascinated when it's their own feud. There's something else, but they're not fascinated. Now, I do start right at the beginning. You know, it took people, you had to have more than one person to establish the first verifiable feud. and it was a doozy. So the thing about Cain and Abel, though, you know, it's terrible what happened. But I've always taken a certain amount of comfort, actually, in the fact that if we read the Bible, which I don't on a regular basis, but if you do, you know that here you have the very first family, Adam and Eve, and all of our, my family, your family, you know, for every family has its issues, you know, and I've always taken a certain amount of comfort that the very first family that we know of was dysfunctional, just like mine. So now, you know, you're in that neck of the woods where you know one Demoulas from another. So New England's most famous family feud, of course, involves the battling cousins Demoulas. Now, to which I devote an entire chapter just because there's so much stuff. This is a literary environment. Anybody know who this is? Who's not wearing x-ray glasses and isn't getting it from the fine print? Yes. Very good. Rudyard Kipling. Rudyard Kipling, who's born in Mumbai, India, becomes the face of Victorian England. So the other thing I found out in my research about feuds in New England is the number of fascinating feuds that took place in New England that involve, like, superstars in whatever field they happen to be in. How many people know where Rudyard Kipling spent three of his most productive years? Very good. Wow. This is tough room. He said Vermont, and he's right. So Rudyard Kipling spent the last 3 years of the 19th century in West Dummerston, basically Brattleboro, Vermont, where he built his dream house, Nolaka, which is a Hindi word meaning gem of gems. And he spent a lot of time there writing. It's, as I said, perhaps it's been argued his three most productive years. That's the study of Nolaka. And he wrote arguably his most famous book, The Jungle Book. Unfortunately for Rudyard Kipling, a couple of years into his Vermont idyll, had a terrible falling out with his brother-in-law. Now, if you have a really awful ongoing family dispute and you live in Marblehead, and you're the family member that you're feuding with lives in Ohio, you know, it may cause you some degree of angst, but you're not going to be at it in each other's face and hair every day. Unfortunately for Rudyard Kipling, his brother-in-law of said dispute lived next door. So there was no getting around it. He left Nolaka and Vermont never to return, which broke his heart. It's very sad. There's an account of Rudyard Kipling on the morning that he and his family were leaving to go to the train and then to a ship in New Jersey to go back to England. He said, as he stared out at the western mountains and Mount Monadnock in the distance, and he said to this close family friend, he said, you know, there are only two places in the world that I have known true peace, Bombay and Vermont, and I can return to neither one. So it was very sad. On the other hand, here's the good news. Nolaka is still there on, appropriately enough, Kipling Road, and you can rent it. You can rent it. You can rent it for a weekend, for a week. It's an amazing experience. And I, for instance, you can sit at Rudyard Kipling's writing desk, as I did, for about an hour and a half. I was determined to actually write something of substance while I sat at Kipling's desk, who's always been an icon for me. I think they were actually going to charge me for the week. Now, there is one family feud in New England that is sort of a twofer in this category, because it's both a family feud and a food fight, and it's not the DeMoulas brothers, although that is a major league food fight. Anybody from Connecticut here? Yeah, what part?
I grew up in Pomfret.
You grew up in Pomfret? Spend any time in New Haven?
No,
not much?
I saw 95 a little bit.
Yeah, sure. So would you have an opinion if someone asked you Pepe's or Sally's?
No.
Rest of you are wondering what the hell is he talking about. Pepe, would you? So how many Pepe's? How many Sally's? How many have no idea what we're talking about? That's why I'm here. Let me elucidate. So in New Haven, Connecticut, in the Italian section, Worcester Street, you will find, I would submit, the best pizza in the world. And I've eaten pizza all through Italy as well. But on Worcester Street, it starts out with Frank Pepe, who emigrates from Naples, Italy in the 20s. By the 30s, he's set up on Worcester Street with Frank Pepe's Pizzeria, making the authentic Neapolitan pizza that he grew up making, which is eaten in Naples, Italy. Now, he has a nephew who works for him, Sally Consiglio. And Sally learns from the master, his uncle, and then does what Frank Pepe did when he branched out on his own. He branched out on his own. So far, so good, right? He just wanted to start his own pizzeria. He'd learned from his uncle. Now he's going to start his own. Sally didn't like to travel too far. Yeah, he didn't like to travel. I mean, at all. Yeah, so two blocks down from his uncle, he opened Sally's. Yeah, so that was a problem. But they're still going strong. But the thing about this is, in Connecticut today, which some of you who know Sally's and Pepe's will verify, you are either Pepe's or Sally's. You know how you're like, you can't be a Red Sox fan and a Yankee fan? You're either Pepe's or Sally's to this day. Where you see, just 2 years ago when I was down there and took this picture of Sally's son, Bobby Consiglio, still working the original brick oven. And if you've never tried either one, I'm a Sally's guy. But if you've never tried either one, you owe it to yourself. Bless you, dear. You owe it to yourself to try both, which I did on the same night and thought I was going to die. So after we establish family feuds in the book, I do get right to the founding feud, which America has its origins in, right? Founding feud, the American Revolution. I mean, you don't get much more of a feud than an actual shooting war. But the thing about... think about America's founding feud is that, here's what's funny. So, of course, we know April 19, 1775. And by the way, I don't have to tell you about Marblehead and Beverly and your own feud, right? Right, because you know that Beverly is the birthplace of... It's okay. In Beverly, I say Marblehead. So it's its own fun. So April 19, 1775, right? Lexington Green, the first shots fired, the shot heard around the world, the British go from there to Concord and the Old North Bridge, where they're met by a far larger force of militia, and their day goes downhill very quickly. But here's the funny thing. Well, it's not funny, ha-ha, but here's the funny thing. So today, we would say that Great Britain, right, is America's closest ally in the world, right? Our most long-time, dependable, closest ally. You know who's still fighting the American Revolution? Concord and Lexington. Concord and Lexington. Still feuding over which town deserves the mantle of birthplace of American liberty. Go figure. Now, there is another feud, again, one that I sort of knew of, but didn't fully appreciate the full flower of its feudity until I began researching this book. So, Bunker Hill, how many folks from New England here? How many New Englanders? Pretty much everybody, right? Okay. So you know, as they would not know in Wichita, that the Battle of Bunker Hill was fought not on Bunker Hill, but on... Thank you. That's so delightful to hear that. Breed's Hill, right? Right? In fact, we just celebrated Bunker Hill Day, right? June 17th, 1775, a battle that the British win, but really it's the ultimate, but lose the war. Things go downhill from there. But here's the funny thing. So it is fought on Breed's Hill, not Bunker Hill. And yet, the most illustrious historians, and I'm talking about people like Nathaniel Philbrick, who perhaps some of you have read some of his books, wonderful writer, preeminent historian. I've interviewed him several times, different books that he's written, but most recently, about 6 years ago now, A Definitive History of Bunker Hill. And in it, Nathaniel Philbrick refers to the misnaming of Bunker Hill as, quote, America's most egregious historical inaccuracy. He called his book Is it just me? Didn't he miss like a teachable moment here? And nonetheless, even though they don't deserve it, generations now, 13, of Bunkers, who are very active, huge family organization in America today, nonetheless, even though they did not earn it, they do not deserve it, they get the monument, the guided missile frigate, community college, cities and towns named after them across America, a drag strip in Indiana. You want weird? A chili sauce. Is Bunker Hill a battle you would think of to name a chili? I mean, maybe like the Alamo, you know? The Battle of the Rio Grande, you know, but Bunker Hill? Yeah, and this is what the Breeds get. This is what the Breeds get. Yeah, that's not even full size. That's, you know, the actual plaque inside the monument there is actually a quarter of that size. And it really irks succeeding generations of Breeds, like my friend Jed Breed from Cambridge, who is a 13th generation descendant of Alan Breed, for whom the actual hill on which the actual battle was fought. Now, I only include one sports. I could have, there are many, 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 many sports rivalries in New England and feuds that I could have included, but there's only one I figured that has its own shorthand because you only have to refer to it as the rivalry, right? It starts out with the most famous Red Sox of all time, who, miracle of miracles, becomes the most famous Yankee of all time, and then it goes down through the decades, through the 40s with DiMaggio and Ted Williams, and then through the 70s with Munson and Fisk. And it leads, of course, to the formation of the Munson-Nixon line, which is the putative boundary between Yankees country and Red Sox country. And it runs right through Hartford, Connecticut, which is perfect because that leads us right to our main course. You hungry for a good feud? This is the greatest feud you've never heard of. You're going to Google this when you go home tonight. But give yourself time, because you're going to go down a rabbit hole, and after 37 links, you'll know what I'm talking about. So, if you see this photograph, you think what? Wright brothers. First flight, right? Early morning hours of December 17th, 1903, Kill Devil Hills, Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. Orville Wright lifts into the air, his brother Wilbur running right alongside, and we have what has been called the most reproduced photograph in history. And 6 years later, they pose for a picture on their porch in Dayton, Ohio. They are now world famous, justly deserved. I want to say at the outset. Justly deserved. Aviation as we know it today stems directly from the Wright brothers. However, perhaps you did you ever hear of Gustav Wright in Pomfret, Connecticut? Oh, I love it. Yeah. But an entire state today, which is, well, we'll get to the legislation they've actually passed in a few minutes, but there are those who would say that this contraption lifted into the air a full 2 years before the Wright brothers. And when I say lifted into the air, I mean with someone aboard, this man. And his name is Gustav Whitehead, born Gustav Weisskopf in Leutershausen, Germany, Bavaria, emigrates to the United States, local connection, a little south of here, but Milton, Massachusetts, where he gets his first job in America at the Blue Hills Weather Observatory. Even as a boy growing up in Germany, Whitehead was known as the bird, which in the late 1800s did not mean being obsessed with flight in the sense of airplanes because they didn't exist yet, but it did mean being obsessed and actually building and experimenting with ever more complicated gliders and kites that were big and strong enough to lift a person, and in his case, designing weather balloons in Milton. Now, by 1901, he has moved on to Bridgeport, Connecticut, and he has now created his 21st flying machine. When I say obsessed, he turned them out as fast as he could crash them, which is what he did. So this is number 21. It would be known as number 21 because all the 20 that preceded it were destroyed. Number 20 flew into the third story of a building in a park in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and this is number 21. Now, first thing you may be wondering, which is what I did when I first heard about Whitehead, is why isn't there a photograph of what he is said to have possibly done? Why isn't there more known about him? And it goes right to, which I found out as I researched, that it really goes to, first and foremost, that we don't learn in anything, not just first flight. History records the winners. That's what I'm trying to say. History records the winners. When it comes to advances in any field, history records the winners, right? Do you know who else was working on the polio vaccine? I don't. I know Jonas Salk, right? Because he won. The Wright brothers won, but they weren't alone. Neither was Jonas Salk. Neither was Alexander Graham Bell. Neither was Henry Ford. None of them. So the first thing you have to jump back and look at is that his contemporaries in his time knew his name. They knew his name. They knew the Whitehead name. This is a contemporary newspaper. This is Popular Aviation, the Popular Mechanics magazine of its time. Huge distribution for its time. Cover story, Gustav Whitehead. So I'm not making this up. But we don't remember the also-rans. We remember the winner. That's who history records. So the first thing to know about the race for first flight is that the Wright brothers were not alone. It takes nothing away from them, but they weren't alone. We grow up, I think, as I recall my own learning about the Wright brothers, that there were these two brothers, and they were quirky, and they built bicycles, and they were obsessed with flying, and they went back and forth for the better part of a decade between Dayton, Ohio, and Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. And then one day, one miraculous morning in December 1903, they finally lifted into the air and first light was born. I call it the myth of immaculate aviation. That happened, but the context was different. They weren't alone. It was much more like the space race of the 50s and the 60s. The U.S. wasn't alone. The U.S. didn't win. Russia won. So it gives you some sense that what we learn about history is often not necessarily the full picture of what happened. It's like that with many things, you know. It's not just first flight. So that's the first thing to know. The other thing to know is that Whitehead, unlike the Wright brothers, actually had an edge on first flight. To do first flight, right? To gain first flight, as it was being raced for, meant a powered, a sustained, a controlled, and a manned, because men were doing it, manned flight. So you had to fly it. There had to be someone aboard. The biggest obstacle was the power source. Okay? The biggest obstacle was the power source. Just like with space, the biggest obstacle was designing a payload that was light enough and yet had enough boost to break the Earth's gravitational pull. With first flight, you needed to have a power source that didn't weigh a lot, but that offered a lot of bang for a small buck. And Gustav Whitehead had an edge here. Because unlike the Wright brothers, who were bicycle builders, that played into their genius in designing a lightweight metal frame for the Wright Flyer. But they had to outsource building an engine, which was required for first flight. They didn't know how to build an engine. Whitehead was an engine builder. He's holding the ingenious engine that he built. It was powered by something that no one had tried yet. People had tried everything. Langley, you talk about some of the names that we don't remember. Langley, Knut, Lilienthal, all racing for first flight, all forgotten. Well, Langley, the Air Force Base is named after him. Langley was using steam power. Water is heavy. What Gustav Whitehead settled on is extremely light, but extremely dangerous, highly flammable. The chemical acetylene burns very hot, very fast, perfect for a flight. So he settled on this, and by the summer of August 1901, he and his crew were fairly confident that it was time to test this. And remember, it's a race. The Wright brothers knew about Whitehead. Everybody knew what everybody was doing. They were all trying to keep tabs on each other. There have long been rumors that the Wrights came to Bridgeport. Never been proved. But everybody was racing each other. So there was no time to waste. So the summer of the August 1901, it's very hot. Been hot. Heat wave. And he and his crew have gone next door, just over the Bridgeport line to Fairfield, Connecticut. They have rolled out a little stretch of dirt road to act as a runway. Unlike the Wright Flyer, which was a biplane, and which used gravity to get into the air, right? They ran a steel track down a steep sand dune. Later on, they even used a catapult. You can't tell it from this picture, but there were two wheels under number 21. Gustav Whitehead will power himself down a runway and lift into the air just like an airplane does today. So it's very hot. They pick the morning. They put the number 21 on a horse-drawn cart. They went over the line into Fairfield, Connecticut. They fueled up, powered up, removed the boulders that acted as rude kind of chocks in front of the wheels. It's pre-dawn, very important. It's pre-dawn, it's dark, before sunrise. This is by design. This is by design. And he lifts off. He flies over a short section of Long Island Sound on his loop back to Bridgeport. This is an artist's rendering of what the number 21 in flight might have looked like. It was said to be a majestic thing. So the question is, did he do it? Well, if he did, this is what the numbers would look like. So the Wright brothers flew for about 120 feet for about 12 seconds at a height of about 6 to 8 feet. Whitehead flew for just under half an hour at a height of 50 feet in the air for over half a mile. So the question that I first had, more than anything else, which I already referenced, was, why is there no picture? Why is there no picture? The Wright brothers got this famous picture. Why is there no picture? Didn't want one. For several reasons. But he flew in the dark by choice. He would have lived the rest of his life in the dark if he could have gotten away with it, but he couldn't have built a plane in the dark. So the first key to perhaps why he was so concerned with not being seen is what he's holding in his arms. His engine is in front of him. He's holding his almost year-old daughter, Rose. He's just started a family. Gustav Whitehead is a German immigrant at a period of rising, sometimes virulent, anti-German sentiment. In less than a decade, World War I will break out in Europe. He speaks very little English, and he has what we would call today uncertain immigration status. Sound familiar? And there was no wall to keep him out. It's my only comment to that. Unless you tempt me. So the only thing that scared Gustav Whitehead more than losing out on winning first flight was losing his family. So he didn't want people to notice. Didn't want a lot of publicity. He got it anyway. There was no way around it, right? Anybody who was racing in first flight, as you saw, there were people who were writing stories about it. The media was following it intently. But he knew that that would have been a whole different order of becoming known. So he didn't want it. He never flew again. He turned instead to what he needed to do, which was support his growing family, by doing what he did best, which was make engine components. This is a component for an engine he built for Curtiss Aviation. 10 years after he flew, commercial aviation is now a going enterprise. So he is designing and building engines. He also built a prototype for a helicopter. And in 1927, he died in Bridgeport, Connecticut, relatively unknown and mostly penniless. And that might have been the end of all we, except some hardy researchers in Connecticut, would have known about Gustav Whitehead. But here's where the Gustav Whitehead story becomes instead this fascinating saga, with ironies sky high in ironies, if you will. So what happens is there's something about this story. There's something about this story that is so fascinating to a succession of people over the course of the next almost 100 years, that somebody comes along with eerie clockwork almost every decade or two, who is not only fascinated by the story, but has a particular skill set that allows them to advance the story in a fascinating way. The first person to come along is an extraordinary woman named Stella Randolph. In the 1930s, she's light years ahead of her time. Fascinating, brilliant woman. In the 1930s, she's a lawyer, a journalist, a teacher, grows up hearing from her dad about the Gustav Whitehead legend, and decides by the late 1930s, 1940-ish, that she could use her skills as an attorney and a journalist to do something that would be crucial to finding out more about and verifying the Whitehead story. And if it isn't done now, it will never be able to be done. Because even though there are no photographs of Whitehead in flight, there are almost 30 eyewitnesses to that day. People who heard it, people who saw it, and she realizes that if their testimony is not given in sworn legal deposition, they'll never be able to be, because they're dying out. They're dying out. So she goes to Bridgeport, she gets sworn eyewitness testimony from all of the eyewitnesses, and that becomes the basis of the first books that are written about Gustav Whitehead, her books, and now the Whitehead story goes beyond Connecticut for the very first time. Goes beyond Connecticut. These books are published, they're read, they're out of print now. But now Connecticut finds itself, by the 1940s, fielding queries from journalists, from researchers, historians, and they're all asking the same question. What do you got on Gustav Whitehead? Come on, Connecticut, what do you got? What are you sitting on? Well, their problem was, Connecticut's problem was, they had only the most rudimentary artifacts, and basically word of mouth, and now Stella Randolph's eyewitness testimony about Gustav Whitehead's flight. But they don't want to be in the position of saying this happened if it didn't happen. They don't want to say it didn't happen if it did happen. So they need an expert to come in and carry out an investigation on the validity of the flight. So they don't have that expertise. They turn to the one institution in America that has that expertise, that can actually put to bear experts in aviation who can determine whether or not there is some validity to the Whitehead flight, the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C. And in the late 1940s, the Smithsonian gives its first definitive answer on whether or not they would carry out this investigation, but it's an answer that never varies all through the decades. No. So Connecticut is very frustrated by this. They wonder why. The first clue as to possibly why has to do with this picture. Now, this is the Wright Flyer. This is the Wright Flyer, sometimes called the most famous plane in history. This is the Wright Flyer on the day that it was unveiled to the public as the Smithsonian's newest and most prized possession. Now, this is Stella Randolph. On her, the gentleman on the far left. I always say, if it's on her right, on his right, and then I have to turn and go, right? So the guy on the far left is the next person who comes along and is fascinated by the Whitehead story. He's fascinated from an aerodynamic standpoint, which is for good reason. His name is Bill O'Dwyer. He's a decorated, retired Air Force major. And he becomes fascinated growing up in Connecticut about whether or not this thing could have flown, whether or not this number 21 could have flown. But he also has a friend, another fascinating person in the succession of people. Now this guy has a truly helpful skill to advance the Whitehead story. If he looks familiar, his name is Lowell Weicker, former governor, former senator from Connecticut. He's a former prosecutor, Doggett, which came into, you know, a lot of people first became familiar with how Lowell Weicker could question a witness when he was on the Watergate Commission. But he's a friend of Bill O'Dwyer. Lowell Weicker also grows up in Connecticut hearing about Gustav Whitehead. He's also become frustrated with why the Smithsonian won't research and investigate the Whitehead claim. But Lowell Weicker has also, by the 1960s, begun to hear a lot of cocktail chatter over the years about a plausible theory why they won't investigate. So when the Wright family donated the Wright Flyer to the Smithsonian, they designed a contract. They executed a contract between the family and the Smithsonian. Standard stuff. Most of it's standard stuff. Maintenance, how preserving it, how safe it will be, security, that sort of thing. There was a clause that stood out, though, to those who had seen it. And Lowell Weicker was determined to see the clause himself. So he used the Freedom of Information Act, which was then a pretty new piece of legislation, in one of its first and most effective uses, and he basically brought the agreement with the Wright family and Smithsonian into public view, and sure enough, there was a clause in that contract which did stand out. And the clause basically said that in taking possession of the Wright Flyer, the Smithsonian may never acknowledge anyone but the Wright brothers as being first in flight. If they do, the Wright family will take back the Wright Flyer. It became known as the Secret Agreement. It became the basis of Stella Randolph's last book, which he co-authored with Bill O'Dwyer, called History by Contract. And now, at this point, by the 1970s, the Smithsonian has opened its Air and Space Museum. The Wright Flyer is now the centerpiece of the Air and Space Museum. And for the first time, the Smithsonian is forced to comment publicly on what has now been called the Secret Agreement, which they say in a press conference, this is completely untrue. It was not a secret. It was just that no one asked us about it. Furthermore, there is no compelling evidence that anyone, including Gustav Whitehead, flew before the Wright brothers, period. Lowell Weicker, the next day, calls his own press conference and said, it's going to be very short. I have only one question. What's the compelling evidence that the Smithsonian investigated? The Smithsonian had no answer. Tom Crouch is the man who gave the first press conference, saying that it wasn't a secret agreement. Terrific guy. I mean, brilliant. Senior aviation curator at the Smithsonian, now retired, knows everything there is to know about the history of American aviation. I interviewed him in the process of writing my book. So Connecticut, though, feels that Tom Crouch should have recused himself from deciding whether or not there was something worth investigating when it came to Gustav Whitehead. Their first problem, which I don't think should have been disqualifying, because nobody is responsible for where they were born. Tom Crouch is born and is a native, like the Wright brothers, of Dayton, Ohio. But he is also was the first official biographer of the Wright brothers. Right. So that, I think, gives Connecticut just a wee bit more justification for how they felt. Nonetheless, all through the 70s and into the 1980s, when asked repeatedly by the state of Connecticut, the Smithsonian declined to investigate the Whitehead claim. So people keep coming along who say they're going to have to ferret out whether or not this could have happened by themselves. And the next person, the third of four people, comes along in the 1980s, is Andy Koch. Andy Koch is an extraordinary teacher, still teaching today in his late 70s in Fairfield, Connecticut. He's a world-class adventurer. He has summited mountain peaks all over the world, parachuted, scuba dived. He is also a master craftsman. And he goes to a lecture given by Bill O'Dwyer about Gustav Whitehead. And he goes up to Bill O'Dwyer at the end of it. He said, "Sir, I know you're a decorated pilot. I'm not, but I'm just curious. Wouldn't it be helpful if we could fly a replica of Whitehead's number 21 and determine at the very least if, in the opinion of people like yourself, it could have flown, whether or not you felt like this thing could have flown?" And Bill O'Dwyer says, "That's a great idea, but good luck with building that. Who's going to build that?" And Andy Koch said, "Actually, I'm planning to." And he did. Now, when I tell you that he was intent on building a painstakingly, authentically reproduced replica, two things. One, as one example, so he's building the fuselage there when he got to the point of a full-scale replica, which didn't come right away. Whitehead used a white muslin that he got imported from India. Koch could have used many things, but he was insistent on there being nothing from the modern era on this plane that didn't exist in Whitehead in 1901, and he got the same white muslin from the same village outside Madras, India. Also, the other part of it was that he first said he would build only a 3/8 replica. And at that point, he would call on a peer-reviewed panel of aviation engineers and experts and would not build a full-size replica unless this panel decided that he was on the right path. And that's the 3/8 replica. The head of Sikorsky Aviation, who was on that panel, is looking over it. They gave him the thumbs up. He built a full-size replica, and he flew it. Now, Andy Koch did not have a pilot's license. Gustav Whitehead didn't have one either, but then you didn't need one in 1901, basically because there was no such thing as a pilot. But in 1986 in Connecticut, you actually needed a license, so he spent $5,000 and he got a pilot's license, and he lifted into the air. Now, here's the thing. I interviewed Andy Koch a couple of times in the process of writing the book. And, you know, as a journalist, I like to think that I'm appropriately skeptical when I need to be, and cynical, which I am by nature. And I said to him, I said, "Andy, one thing. Look, I know from everything I've read that you rebuilt this replica. You built this replica to the tiniest detail of authenticity." But I said, "What about intangibles? What about things that aren't known, can never be known? What if the Wright brothers had a strong tailwind that isn't recorded, wasn't recorded? What if Whitehead didn't?" He said, listen. "All I can tell you is this. So for starters, Whitehead's number 21 came in at flight at 202 pounds. That's with him in it, fully fueled up. When they finished building the replica, it was 198 pounds. So they immediately thought they would be accused of, of course, it was lighter. So they added a 50-pound sandbag. Then, when Andy Koch took off, what he told me was, he said, "Look, as we released the chocks in front of the front wheels, started a roll, I turned to the tiller." There was a tiller on this thing. He said, "And my watch fell off." This was no ordinary watch. The watch had an altimeter on it, which was key to knowing whether or not they would reach 50 feet. So he said, "I started immediately looking for the watch, and then I thought the only thing worse than losing the watch would be this thing turning off onto the runway here somewhere and cracking up." So he said, "I immediately brought myself into the upright position," and he said, "I was already 35 feet off the ground. All that thing wanted to do," he said, "was get into the air," which it did. He flew for almost an hour using up the entire tank of acetylene. He landed, got a hero's welcome in Bridgeport, and now the story goes national. 60 Minutes did a story a year later of the rights wrong. And now comes along the last and final and fourth person who takes us up to the present day, who is the most significant person to advance the Whitehead story in ways that couldn't have been imagined back in Stella Randolph's day. His name's John Brown. Grew up, knew nothing about Gustav Whitehead. He may have known nothing about the state of Connecticut or that it even existed, but he has a good excuse. He has a good excuse. He grew up in Melbourne, Australia. He is an aviation historian. He is also an aviation investigator, which will be key. He's a detective. He's a detective. He investigates the forensics sometimes of fatalities, but also whether or not varying flights historically are what they claim to be. But he didn't know anything about Whitehead. But here is the most stunning irony of the entire Whitehead story. So in 2000, the Smithsonian wants to do a series of television specials on the history of American aviation. They do a worldwide search kind of thing, you know, they, as the Smithsonian could. Who would be the best producer? Who is just an interesting guy, colorful, loves aviation, knows everything there is about John Brown. They hire him. Actually, they. Tom Crouch hires him. A decision he regrets to this day. So he hires him. And John Brown comes over to the United States. He's learned everything there is to know about aviation. He also has a photographic memory, which will come into play. And he comes over for his first meeting with Tom Crouch. And they're in Tom Crouch's office in Washington. And they're talking about how they're going to produce these specials. And at the end of the meeting, John Brown is kind of jovially says to Tom Crouch, "Hey, Tom," as John Brown puts it, as he described it to me, he said, I was literally putting my papers back in my briefcase, and I said over my shoulder, "Hey, Tom, don't want to forget, what do you know about Gustav Whitehead?" These were the first words out of Tom Crouch's mouth. John Brown said, I stood upright like someone had hit me in the back of the head. Because remember, he's a detective. To his detective ear, what he's heard just now is what a detective calls a tell. Someone has just volunteered something that in a way has nothing to do with the question they were just asked, but speaks in some evident way to some other agenda. And he decides in that moment he's going to devote 8 months that he has available to finally finding out once and for all what the deal is with Gustav Whitehead. It only took him a week to uncover something that Connecticut believed didn't exist. A contemporaneous newspaper account, next day's edition of the Bridgeport Herald, local man, flies over Long Island Sound. Then he goes to Leutershausen, Germany, to spend 2 weeks in Whitehead's hometown. He spends an entire afternoon combing through the attic of the Whitehead Museum, and he finds his picture. Now, this is the picture he found, right? There's a picture in a picture that draws his eye. Draws his eye because of his photographic memory. So, he remembers that eyewitness testimony number 27 of Stella Randolph was a bank custodian in Bridgeport, Connecticut, who on the morning that Whitehead flew, actually just as this guy arrived at the bank to open it up in Bridgeport, to go inside and get it ready to open, it was about 5:35 a.m. That was almost to the minute the time that Whitehead landed back in Bridgeport. And this testimony spoke of hearing what sounded like a lawnmower over my head, which is exactly what it would have sounded like. Exactly what it would have sounded like. Furthermore, he said, when I looked up, he said, I saw what looked like a man on the roof next door who had a wooden tripod with what looked like a box camera. If a photograph was shot from that camera, than it may have been. This was reproduced. This photograph was blown up. John Brown had it blown up at a local police station in Leutershausen 300 times. If the if that picture was taken, then it may have been. Number 21, as it landed on a vacant lot on Pine Street in Bridgeport, Connecticut. The Smithsonian calls this photograph the smudge. So now the story, John Brown is now speaking. He's back in the States. He is giving talks about Whitehead. He is giving basically Tom Crouch high blood pressure on a daily basis. And it's getting picked up by all kinds of news outlets and magazines now. And in 2013, John Brown has a meeting with the editors of Jane's All the World's Aircraft. Jane's is considered the Bible of world's aviation. The editors are at an air show in Frankfurt, Germany, and John Brown asks them for a meeting. He'd like to lay out what he thinks they will find some rather stunning evidence about first flight. They give him half an hour. An hour and a half later, the meeting breaks up. That's in March. 2 months later, their centennial edition of Jane's All the World's Aircraft is released. Inside the front cover, there is an announcement from a senior editor of Jane's in which they say that they now believe, based on cumulative evidence built up over the last almost 100 years, that Gustav Whitehead, a German immigrant, flew 2 years before the Wright brothers. That is all Connecticut has to hear. So for 100 years, they have been told by North Carolina, by the Smithsonian, I don't know what you're smoking up there in Bridgeport. So in June 2013, the Connecticut State Assembly, without a single dissenting vote, try doing that on any other issue today, passes a bill which makes Connecticut the only state in America that recognizes someone other than the Wright brothers as being first in flight. So the question is, to wrap up, does it change anything? My own feeling is that no, it does not. It doesn't change anything in the sense that the Wright brothers have the photograph. Gustav Whitehead made a choice. He may have flown that morning. I think he did. But he made a choice not to get evidence. And it was a fateful choice. It was a fateful choice. If you go to Kitty Hawk today, as if any of you have, you know there is this soaring, stunning, beautiful monument to the Wright brothers. If you go to Bridgeport today, I wouldn't call it soaring. All I can tell you is if you want to see the Whitehead Monument in Bridgeport and you reach this intersection, pray for a red light. Goes by very fast. It took them a year and a half just to afford the marble inscription at the bottom. But I will tell you this. As I wrap up this chapter in the book and as I wrap up this, in Bridgeport, Connecticut, they know what they know. They know what they have known for 100 years. There isn't a child in Bridgeport, Connecticut that doesn't know about the legend of Gustav Whitehead. They respect the Wright brothers. Aviation as we know it today comes from the Wright brothers. Not Whitehead. Never flew again. But they do believe with all their heart in Bridgeport that on a hot summer morning in 1901, a German immigrant lifted into the sky and flew first. And they also believe that North Carolina, at the very least, should change its license plate. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Let me just flip these lights on here. Thank you. So, that's not it. Oh, that probably turned the lights off in all the bathrooms, right? Now, if anybody has any questions, I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you, Patty. It doesn't have to be about Whitehead. We've just spent the quarter of our life just now talking about Gustav Whitehead. And I apologize. But it doesn't have to be about Whitehead. It can be about any other feud. It doesn't have to be about a feud. We can talk about the weather, whatever you want. But I'll be happy to take any questions. Anybody. Yes, ma'am, and then I'll get to you. Yes.
Where is the exact
Where does the expression wicked come from? Well, you know, it was first popularized, well, the British, because it's, you know, it's sort of fun to blame them for everything in New England. But the, if you look, go back, it was sometimes spelled with a D, an E, and it was first popularized for some strange reason. You'll find it appearing earlier and in more colloquial usage in Maine than any other part of New England. And you know, if you know Maine, that is an essential element of a Mainer's vocabulary, is wicked. Wicked! That was wicked good. But other than that, there's no one that can say definitively where it comes from. It's not used in the same way anywhere else but New England. And so it is a one of those absolutely quintessential New Englandisms. You know, I had a discussion early on. My feeling was, I don't know if push came to shove and they said no dice, but my feeling was I would only do the book with this title. I felt as a New Englander myself, you know, it just had to be, right? Because in New England, if it's really hot, it's wicked hot. If it's really cold, it's wicked cold. If you eat something delicious, it's wicked good. If you're really, really mad, you're wicked pissed, you know? The only time I had second thoughts, frankly, was about a year, and I was writing one night at home in my office, and I had this up on not quite that big, but on a fairly big screen, and my then 9-year-old daughter, a younger daughter, came in, and I was aware that she was standing there, and I turned around, and she said, she actually didn't say anything. What she did was she walked out. About 5 minutes later, my wife came in and said, your daughter says you're typing dirty words in here. So that was the only time I questioned it for just a minute. I told her, honey, if that's the dirtiest word you ever hear, you will have led a very charmed life. Yes, ma'am. Whitehead. He changed his name to Whitehead when he emigrated. Yeah. But the German was Weisskopf. Yes. Anyone else? Yes, ma'am.
What's your take on the Navy?
On the Navy? Marblehead. Actually, it is. It is. Come on. You got John Paul Jones in there. And everything. Come on. What's yours? So?
I live here.
and I'm a guest here. Anyone else?
What's your...
No, go ahead, and then I'll get... Yep.
What's your favorite feud in your book?
Well, this is my favorite feud. Yeah. Yeah, the Whitehead feud. Yeah, I mean, it's my favorite. But there are others that... that are certainly I got, you know, very fond of. And some were just fun to research, like, you know, the clam wars on, you know, Route 133, you know. I mean, that was tough research. So I'm curious, show of hands, best fried clams. Woodman's?
No.
Ah, this is interesting, right. Wait a minute. Farnham's?
Yes.
Okay, respectable showing. Clam box. Yeah. Yeah. Isn't that interesting?
And you?
I want to continue to be able to eat for free at all three. So, I'm kidding. I will say this. I have dear friends at Woodman's, wonderful people, and may have invented the fried clam, if you read their own material. But no, they probably did. But here's the thing. You know that Woodman's is a huge success story and has earned it. So, you know, my first problem with Woodman's, I will often go to Woodman's and say hi to Steve Woodman if it's during the day, if it's a weekday, especially not summertime. And I will. I'll go in there and I'll have a bite there. If it's summer, I don't go near the place. And that's no knock on Woodman's. I mean, look, you know, it's like Yogi Berra, right? The great thing he said, you know, it's the place has gotten so popular, nobody goes there anymore, right? But I think that both Farnham's and the Clam Box make fantastic fried clams. I think that Farnham's is the less greasy of all three, which appeals to me.
Yeah.
But I think that the clam box are the most flavorful, frankly.
What means you can get them gluten-free, so that's...
You can, that's right, that's right, that's right. And, you know, Chicky at the clam box is, you know, that she's maniacal about changing the oil as often, way more frequently than most places do, and I think that probably accounts for the taste, too. You know, I haven't had dinner yet, so I'm getting off this subject. Ma'am, you had a question in the back.
I have a chronicle question.
Okay. How we choose what topics we cover on Chronicle.
About researching it.
Right, right.
So when we see a program on TV, what's happened behind it to produce it?
Right, right. A lot of vicious infighting. So how do we choose stories? Every which way you can imagine, for one thing. There is no one way, obviously. You know, we come across stories the same way that anyone else does, too. Mind you, you know, we're all people that are, you know, a lot of us are news junkies like me, but, you know, we read newspapers, we're online all the time, we see things as we drive around. Everybody has their own way. I can tell you for myself, there is no one way. And for me, that's part of the joy of it, is the number of ways that I have found out about some of my, you know, most memorable stories. People write me, people email me, people call me, and I say, write good old snail mail. And it's actually my favorite. I mean, I don't know if they email this, but very often if someone tells me that I'm getting in touch with you because I thought you might find this interesting, my Uncle Roy, who's 97, lives in Dudley, and in his basement, he has spent 50 years, that's all I got to see. That's all I got to see. And you know what I mean? So, but also... Just driving around, I can't tell you the number of times I have stumbled on a great story. Just because I have my eyes open, I am constantly curious. Constantly. My wife can't believe I haven't had more multi-car collisions. Because I'm constantly like, what the? You know? And I'll write something down right away, and then I'll turn around, I'll go back. There are people all over New England who have opened their front door, their side door, and found me standing there and simply saying, I'm sorry, can I just ask, what is that thing in your driveway? Right? And so... that's fun too. And then once you settle on something, you know, we have to clear the hurdle of pitching it to my editor, my executive producer, and our managing editor. And, you know, that's gotten easier over the years. You know, those senior people there, you know, usually there's some level of trust that you've found a good story. It's probably a good story. And then we go about, you know, setting it up. So it's about a month from settling on a story to when it airs. Sometimes it's a little longer, but it's about a month, especially if it involves some travel. It's generally about a month. Yes. Anyone else? So, yes.
I don't know if it was on TV or here. You talk on the Vermont Man. I think I don't know if it's still.
It was here, but it was also on Chronicle. Yes. Yes. So I always say that's my favorite story of all, ever. Yeah. So what the question is about this wonderful Vermont man. And when I talk about my other book, and so if you were here the first time, I did, I always begin by saying that people ask me if I have a favorite story of all over my 20 plus years reporting around New England. And I always say, I'm delighted that not only do I have a favorite story, but I can sum up my favorite story ever with a four-letter word, Fred. So Fred Tuttle is the Vermont dairy farmer that this woman is talking about. And anybody ever heard of Fred? So Fred is a former, he was a dairy farmer. He became the most unlikely movie star, you know, perhaps in America's history. And he was the subject of at least two or three Chronicle stories over the years. And he was a big part of my first book. So, right. Well, that's funny coming in an election year. Thank God you're here. But this is why I bring my Aunt Ethel to every single
I'm Italian.
So what she's referring to, what's your name? Rose. What Rose is referring to is that Fred Tuttle had all these chapters to his life, which are just defy belief. So his neighbor was a filmmaker, and his neighbor decided to make a film about a Vermont dairy farmer who was trying to keep afloat and settled on the one job that he thought he could get that would give him what he needed. He needed a job that paid pretty well, that didn't require any higher education, and it didn't require any heavy lifting, and it didn't require, and it also came with great health care. So he settled on running for Congress. And in the movie, he won. The movie was called Man with a Plan. It became the highest grossing film in Vermont state history. Right? So it's crazy already. And then 3 years later in 1998, the buzz is starting to die down, and John O'Brien, who was the filmmaker, and Fred, they decided they wanted to come up with some way to get some new life and new buzz around, but they had no budget. And so they thought, let's run Fred for real this time. What the hell? What the hell? We know how to do it for fake. So they ran him for the Senate against Vermont Senior Senator Pat Leahy. And he almost won. So he did. He ran against Pat Leahy, and it got all kinds of publicity. You can only imagine. Toward the end of the campaign, Fred made good on his word, which was that all I'm saying is, he'd say, I love Leahy. I love Leahy. I'm sure he's going to win, which did not endear him to the Vermont State Republican Party. And sure enough, 1 week before Election Day, Fred called a press conference and officially endorsed his opponent, Pat Leahy. He said, I told you, I think he's going to win. And Leahy won. But Pat Leahy, who I spoke with many times about, who does an uncanny Fred Tuttle imitation, he will tell you to this day, Pat Leahy has never lost the race. From attorney general to governor to senator, has never lost the race. He said, that race was the scariest race I was ever in. And Fred got 20% of the vote. But it's funny to think of that in this election year, because, that was also. So listen, great questions. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for coming out tonight. I really appreciate it. No, thank you. Thank you. And if you would like to purchase a copy of the book, I would be delighted to sign one for you. I'll set up camp right here in this chair, and I'd be happy to sign a book for you, whether you buy a book or not. I also have a newsletter list right here. I'm at work on a third book, and what I try to do, I say try. What's it about? It is about, so there's two things when I travel around New England. There's two things that I can't drive by without dropping in. Never if it's one that I haven't been in before, and in many cases, if it's one that I'm familiar with, I've already planned to stop there. One is a diner, and the other is a good, authentic, old-time general store. And it turns out that there has been nothing written about the history of New England's general stores, so that's what I'm at work on now. But if you would like to be in the loop, because what I try to do is send out at least a couple of newsletters a year, I usually fail. So in signing, you're giving me your email address. Well, the first thing I can do is guarantee you, you will receive no unwanted spam from me, because you'll probably never hear from me again. So it's either a sort of leap of faith, or it's some gesture of genuine belief in my work. But if you'd like to give me your email address, I will put you on my email list, and I will be getting out a newsletter before this book comes out. So thank you again very much. Thank you.